About the Lie derivative and gauge transformations. And we had this formula on the board, which is the Lie derivative of the unperturbed of an unperturbed FRW metric with respect to an arbitrary vector field epsilon. And we're talking about gauge modes. It's the context of where the Lie derivative came up. And the way to think about gauge modes is that if I have some perturbation around the FRW background, and I change coordinates, if I apply some infinitesimal, some small change of coordinates, then the perturbations shift like this. If I start with a unperturbed FRW background, for example, and apply a small change of coordinates, that will look like a perturbation. Or more generally, I can transform one set of perturbations into another. I'm imagining a situation where I have a first order perturbation and the gauge transformation that I apply is also first order in perturbation theory. So since I'm not keeping track of second order terms, I won't keep track of second order terms, then the Lie derivative here just acts on the background metric, the zeroth order metric, and not on the perturbations. So a gauge mode arises because I can apply this gauge transformation to an unperturbed background, and it will look like there's a perturbation. But that's an unphysical perturbation that doesn't have any dynamics. It's just an artifact of the coordinate system. And likewise, if I start with a non-zero perturbation and apply this transformation, then I can obtain a different looking perturbation, which is physically equivalent. There are four gauge modes, and they are the modes that you get from the right-hand sides here for some choice of epsilon zero and epsilon I. So if a perturbation delta phi delta g mu nu is of this form for some choice of epsilon zero and epsilon I, then it's a gauge mode. Now I want to talk about the concept of gauge fixing. Gauge fixing simply refers to the removing of this ambiguity, the fact that we have different sets of perturbations that are secretly physically equivalent, by imposing some conditions. For example, in general, delta phi can be shifted around by a gauge transformation. And if I start with an arbitrary perturbation, it's easy to see that I can always set delta phi to zero. I can just remove the phi part of the perturbation through a suitable choice of coordinates or by making a gauge transformation. That's clear from the equations because the L epsilon here is just epsilon phi dot epsilon zero. So if I start with a non-zero delta phi and make a gauge transformation with epsilon zero equals minus delta phi over phi dot, then in the new transform coordinates, the inflaton perturbation will be zero. And the way to think about that is that if I have a perturbation, then the surfaces of constant phi are not the constant time hypersurfaces of the coordinate system. But I can always just, it's easy to see in the cartoon that I can always change coordinates so that the constant time surfaces of the coordinate system are the same as the level curves of phi. In other words, I just use phi as the clock. There's no preferred clock in relativity. You can use any time coordinate as you want. If you just use phi as the clock, then phi is a function of t alone and it doesn't have any perturbation. So this uses up one quarter of the gauge symmetry, since there are four functions to work with when you choose the gauge, and I've imposed one constraint. Now the remaining, I have the freedom to impose three more constraints before I fully fix the gauge. And if you make different, there are different choices of gauge that one can make, And the inflationary calculation can be easier or harder depending on which choice you make. I know because I've done this calculation, which choice will make the calculation easiest. That's not to say it will be easy, but it will be easiest if I make the following choice. So I don't claim to have a deep motivation for this. I just know that the calculation will work out most simply that way. So first some minor notation. I'm going to take the metric, the space part of the metric gij, and write it this way. Where the matrix gamma is traceless. This isn't a gauge choice, it's just a change of variables. I just take the space part of the metric, pull out the trace, and make that, I call that zeta. And then when I remove, or rather, 1/6 of zeta would be the trace. And then whatever's left over, I call gamma. That's a traceless matrix. So the gauge choice that I want to make is after I make this change of variables from gij to zeta and gamma ij, then I want this condition to be true. That's three equations since there's an uncontracted I index on the left-hand side. And so that uses up the remaining three components of the gauge symmetry. Now I thought it would be useful to show at the level of counting degrees of freedom, it seems plausible that starting from an arbitrary perturbation delta phi comma delta g mu nu, then there exists a unique gauge transformation that will bring the fluctuations into a form where these conditions apply. And that's a plausible statement because it's true at the level of counting degrees of freedom. I have four equations here, and there are four free functions that I can choose. And so it makes sense that I could solve four equations for four unknowns uniquely and always bring the metric to this gauge. But I think it's kind of useful because this type of, there are sometimes loopholes in this, and this type of calculation often comes up to show that that's true. So let's prove it. So let's prove that starting from an arbitrary perturbation delta phi delta g mu nu, there is a unique epsilon zero epsilon I such that the gauge conditions hold. Delta phi is delta j m I j. Okay. So we need to know if we define qj to be delta j gamma ij, then we need to know how this object, this three vector, transforms under a gauge transformation. So first, I know how the components of Gij transform under the gauge transformation. I just need to get from there to Qj. So first, let me write the following formula for gamma. Gamma ij is, so to get gamma ij, I take the perturbation in the metric, and then I make it traceless by subtracting off the trace. It's easy to see that the term that you need to subtract is this. To make it traceless, I take the trace and then I subtract that times 1/3 the identity matrix. And gamma is defined with this factor of a to the minus 2. It follows then, if you plug in this form of the gauge transformation with the components of the Lie derivative on the upper board, that gamma transforms under a gauge transformation as follows. There are some cancellations that happen when you remove the trace and you get this. Under a gauge transformation, gamma shifts by the traceless matrix on the right-hand side. And Q which is defined as this derivative of gamma shifts as follows. I get one term that looks like when I contract with partial I get a Laplacian here. And then these two terms each give the same thing with coefficients of 1 and minus 2/3. So I get this. Epsilon I. Okay. So we know how Q transforms under a gauge transformation epsilon. We know how phi transforms under a gauge transformation epsilon. And so what we need to see then is that need to solve these equations. So starting from an arbitrary delta phi, I want to apply a gauge transformation and set it to zero. And starting from an arbitrary QJ, I want to apply this transformation, gauge transformation, and remove it. Okay, so you could think of this as having an arbitrary pair of sources on the right-hand side, arbitrary functions. And I want to solve these equations for epsilon 0 and epsilon I. So the first one is easy. Okay, I solved it. But the second one is a non-trivial looking partial differential equation. So let's think about how we would solve that. Who has a suggestion for how you might go about, give it a Q, solving this equation for epsilon? At hand waving level, it maybe seems kind of obvious that we have three equations and three unknowns, so there'll be a unique solution. But when you write down the equation that actually needs to be solved, it's not so trivial.
Would it help start like seeing the homogeneous case and then?
That is sort of often what I do when I face the tough equation as I think about special cases.
Transform it, right?
Yeah, that's the answer that I was looking for. Yeah, so like the heavy hammer that will really help deal with this is to write it in Fourier space. So this is a linear differential equation involving derivative operators. And so the magic of the Fourier transform is that in Fourier space, I'll put the k's and the epsilon, no? Well, maybe I should denote this by I so that I don't have k sub k. In Fourier space, I now just have an algebraic, the different k's decouple. And I have an algebraic equation for each k mode of epsilon in terms of the k modes of q, independently of every other k mode. That generally happens when I have a linear differential equation and I translate it to Fourier space. Okay, so now I can just pretend there are no derivatives in the problem. How would you go about seeing that this equation has a solution? For if I just think one Fourier mode at a time, I have one three-component vector qj. I want to solve for a three-component vector epsilon. Oh, yeah, that's true, right, yeah. So that's a good suggestion, actually. What I have here on the... That's a good suggestion. What I have here on the left-hand side is just some matrix, some k-dependent matrix. And so if I compute the determinant, then it'll be zero or non-zero, and I can tell whether there's a unique solution. I think that's a correct answer. I had done it slightly differently, which is, of course, you'll be able to write out the determinant and compute it. I had done it slightly differently by saying, well, I'll rotate. You know, there's a symmetry here that I haven't used. The usefulness of the Fourier transform in this example comes because the equation has translation symmetry. And I haven't used the rotation symmetry yet. So if I rotate to a basis where, if I write this equation down in a basis where the Fourier mode points in the z direction, then you'll see that the matrix appearing on the left-hand side is just this. And so because none of these entries on the diagonal can be zero, then the matrix is invertible and there's a unique solution. So using the symmetry rotating to this basis, the matrix is one way to say it is that the matrix is diagonal, so you don't need to think about the determinant. Okay. So that's the end of my discussion of the Lie derivative and gauge invariance. The bottom line for the inflationary calculation is that there is a gauge invariance in the problem, which can be removed by just assuming that these gauge conditions apply. I'll just remove variables by setting delta phi to zero and imposing this particular gauge condition on gamma. Okay. Next topic. I want to talk about extrinsic curvature and the ADM formalism. So first, just a little qualitative discussion. The GR notation is so powerful that Einstein's 10 field equations take this ultra-compact form. However, this compactness, this notational compactness, does obscure the nuts and bolts of how the equations work and how you evolve things forward in time. It's not obvious, for example, which of these 10 equations, when written out, are going to contain time derivatives, or how you would step the equations forward on a computer. A related conceptual puzzle is that it looks like there are 10 fields in Einstein's equations, but on physical grounds, we expect there to be 2 dynamical degrees of freedom in general relativity. Like when LIGO looks for a gravity wave, they're looking for a wave with 2 polarizations, two helicities, plus or minus 2 helicities. Not a gravity wave with 10 polarizations. So how do we get from 10 to 2, since it looks like in the equations there are 10 independent fields that you would be evolving forward? A related question you can ask is whether GR has an initial value formulation. So a sensible field theory in physics should have the property that if I specify the values of the fields on some initial time slice, let me be a little vague about what I mean by that. Like maybe I specify the metric and one or more of its time derivatives. Might not be clear in advance what order the differential equations are, so how many time derivatives you need to specify. But let's just say I specify the metric and a few time derivatives. Then I would like to prove that Einstein's field equations have a unique solution which fully determine the metric at some later time. That's what I would mean by an initial value formulation. Now, as usually written, Einstein's field equations do not have an initial value formulation. The metric and as many derivatives as you want at some initial time do not determine the metric at some later time. Let me prove to you that statement is true. That is actually a formal consequence of gauge invariance. Because if I start with one solution of Einstein's equations, then I can always generate another solution by applying a gauge transformation, where the parameter epsilon is has field degrees of freedom. The epsilon zero and the epsilon I can be functions of space and time. And in particular, I can choose an epsilon which is zero here. And I could even make it zero for half of this interval so that nothing happens to any of the derivatives, nothing happens for a while. Epsilon is zero. And then I just turn on an epsilon here. That will leave because of the gauge invariance of general relativity, if I have one solution of Einstein's equations and I apply a gauge transformation, I'm guaranteed to get another solution. And so starting from one solution, I can do this trick of a gauge transformation which is zero for a while and then becomes non-zero and get another solution which has different values of the metric on the later time slice. Of course, those values those two solutions will just differ by a gauge mode, so we should think of them as being physically equivalent. But strictly speaking, at the level of formal math, Einstein's equations do not have an initial value formulation in the sense that the components of the metric at one time determine it at later times. They only determine it up to a gauge mode. So this means that Einstein's equations, generally speaking, are both are underdetermined. Are underdetermined, and they're also redundant. And to explain what I mean, let me show you a toy example of an underdetermined redundant system. This is going to be a set of differential equations, ordinary differential equations. There'll be no x, just time. I'm going to show you three ordinary differential equations in three variables. So you might think, but if I, in any situation where I have three variables and three first order differential equations, so I'm going to fill in the right hand sides here, they're going to be functions of x, y, and z. Let me erase that. Let me be a little more mysterious and just say I'm going to write three ordinary differential equations. You might think that I'm all set. If I have three differential equations in three unknowns, then I'll always be able to evolve. But here's a loophole. Let's say that this is in this toy example, it's kind of an interesting loophole. But let's say the differential equations that I gave you were these. Then there's just no equation of motion for z. If I start with one solution to the differential equation and then form a different solution by choosing z differently, I can take it to be any function of time. Formally, that will also be a solution to the differential equations. And that's what's going on with the gauge modes in general relativity. In this toy example, there's one mode of the function z that just doesn't have an equation of motion. And likewise, in GR, the gauge modes just don't have equations of motion. If you try to compute them, you'll get something like 0 equals 0. And so the solution to this problem is obvious. You just don't talk about modes that don't have equations of motion. You just forget about z and say that I have some differential equations in x and y, and everything's fine. And that's what the gauge fixing does for you in general relativity. It just throws out degrees of freedom that don't have equations of motion. In this example, by the way, the underdeterminedness of the equations also means that the equations are redundant. I can take any two of them and get the third. And the same is true in general relativity. Even though Einstein's equations are 10 equations, they're redundant in the sense that there are only 6 independent equations, and the remaining 4 can be derived from those. So we're halfway to explaining how, in general relativity, you get from 10 degrees of freedom to 2. We explained how you get to 6 degrees of freedom by throwing away the gauge modes. Now here's another loophole. Consider the statement that if I have 3 ordinary differential equations and 3 unknowns, then I can always evolve forward. This was one loophole where the equations were redundant and underdetermined, and there were modes that just didn't have equations of motion. Here's another loophole. Consider this toy example. X dot equals x, y dot equals y, x dot plus y dot equals z. Well, that's 3 differential equations and 3 unknowns. But if I take an appropriate combination of them, I get z equals 0. And so in this example, so that's like the equation of motion for z, if you want. It has a non-dynamical equation of motion. No, I'm sorry, I did this wrong. The equation of motion is, you can derive z equals x plus y. So x and y are dynamical quantities in this example, in that there are differential equations that you evolve forward. But z is non-dynamical. It just worked out, given these equations of motion, that z is just always given by x plus y. It doesn't have independent dynamics. It just goes along for the ride. And the same is true in general relativity. Out of the 6 degrees of freedom that you will get after you fix a gauge, it will be the case that the Einstein's equations, if you torture them enough and work with them, then you can write them in a form where 4 of those fields are non-dynamical. Their equations of motion just don't contain time derivatives. They're just auxiliary quantities that are determined by the dynamical fields. And 2 of the equations, two of the fields, the degrees of freedom, will be dynamical, in the sense that their equations of motion are differential equations. They'll turn out to be second order differential equations, a small difference from the toy example.
Couldn't I derive also z dot equals z? Like I take a dot of the third equation and that gives me z dot equals x double dot plus y double dot, which is equal to x dot plus y dot, which is equal to z.
Oh, that's true, yeah. That's why it can look like.
Yeah.
Well, this follows from this, but not vice versa. Like, you lost information.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Notice in this example, nothing is redundant or underdetermined. You need all 3 of the equations. You can't derive any one of them from the other 2. None of these, there are no gauge modes. There's nothing that doesn't have an equation of motion. It's just that some of the variables turn out to be non-dynamical. So one thing we're going to do is write Einstein's, the property of gauge invariance is relatively easy to find. But it's not easy to write Einstein's equations, generally speaking, in such a way that the non-dynamicalness of 4 of the degrees of freedom is manifest. So that's one thing we're going to figure out how to do. The way that this is done will involve a new type of geometric object called the extrinsic curvature. So I want to draw some pictures for that. So consider this question. Let's say that I have a space, sigma prime, with a metric. I consider a hypersurface in the space, some space sigma with one lower dimension. The metric g prime on the ambient space sigma prime induces a metric g on sigma. You might wonder whether there's a relationship between the curvature of the induced metric on sigma and the curvature of the ambient space sigma prime. For example, a simple possibility that is unfortunately too simple to be right is that the Riemann curvature tensor of the hypersurface is equal to the Riemann curvature tensor of the ambient space. That's not enough as the example of, that's not the case, as the example of a sphere embedded in a flat three-dimensional space shows. There, R prime is zero, but R is non-zero. But there is a theorem that the curvature of sigma always equals the curvature of sigma prime plus some additional terms that look like this. Where K is a new object called the extrinsic curvature. The geometric concept that K is trying to quantify is just whether the embedding of sigma in sigma prime is a curved embedding or a flat one. And so to motivate the definition, I'm going to write down the definition, but to motivate it, the way that you might tell if this is a little, let's say a line on the surface sigma, the way you might decide whether that is a curved line or a straight line in the ambient space is to consider the unit normal vector. I'm going to call that eta. I can't call it n because there are already too many n's in the subject, as you'll see shortly. And then I ask if an observer living in sigma prime parallel translates eta, takes the covariant derivative of eta along the line, then if the line is flat, then the sigma prime observer will say that the covariant derivative is zero. And whereas if I have a curved embedding, then the sigma prime observer will say that there's some non-zero covariant derivative, which is tangent to the surface. And so the definition of the intrinsic curvature is simply that it is the covariant derivative of the unit normal vector, the primed covariant derivative, the covariant derivative as calculated by a sigma prime observer. So I take eta, I nabla prime it in some tangent direction mu, and then I ask whether that covariant derivative has a non-zero projection into some other tangent direction nu. So this matrix is the extrinsic curvature. It's not obvious from the definition that it's symmetric in mu nu, but a symmetric matrix, but that will turn out to be true. Here is something that doesn't have much to do with general relativity, but it's so fun I just had to talk about it. If you take a piece of paper, you might notice that there's no problem folding it in the x direction or in the y direction, but there's no way to fold it in both directions at once without the paper ripping. There's always like a flat direction to the folding. Here's a high-powered explanation for why that's true. If the dimension of the hypersurface is 2, and in no other case, you can show that, so if the dimension of the hypersurface is 2, then this particular combination of matrix elements on the right-hand side turns out to be equal to the determinant of the 2 by 2 matrix K times some tensor. Now, if you think about the folded, if you think about sigma being a piece of paper folded up in R flat 3 space, sigma prime, then R prime is 0. And the intrinsic curvature of the paper has to be 0, no matter how it's folded. That is what's so interesting about curvature, is that it's an intrinsic property of the surface, just defined by distances on the surface. When I fold the paper, I don't change the distance as seen by an observer that lives in the paper between two points in the paper. So the right-hand side, since these guys are both 0, then this has to be 0. The determinant of the extrinsic curvature has to be 0. That is to say, the matrix K has to have a 0 eigenvalue. That's the flat direction. there'll always be some direction like this that corresponds to a 0 eigenvalue in K. And you can have one direction like this with a non-zero eigenvalue, but you can't have 2. Okay. Back to general relativity. So I want to think about extrinsic curvature in a situation where the hypersurfaces are the constant time, where you have the hypersurface sigma prime is the constant time hypersurface in some spacetime. That's not really a reduction in generality, because there's no preferred time coordinate in general relativity. It can just be any time, can just be any function. And so just like, you know, I could take a sphere in flat 3 space and make it look like a basis surface by using spherical coordinates. I can take sort of an arbitrary hypersurface in a spacetime and just choose a time coordinate choose coordinates appropriately so that it's the constant time surface in some coordinate system. The only thing that's different in the GR case is that now the unit normal vector satisfies the condition eta mu is minus 1, which will change some signs. Now, when I do computations in this situation, this 3 plus 1 dimensional situation, then it's very convenient to use what are called the ADM variables. And so this is just a change of variable from the usual way of writing down the 4 metric to some new set of variables denoted. There's a scalar n, a vector n upper I, and a 3x3 matrix. One way of writing it down is like this.
Or matrix notation like this.
Or in like a block matrix notation. So this is just a change of variables. I didn't like choose a gauge or do any physics. And I just replaced G00 and G0i by n and ni. One way to think about this is just completing the square. So I leave the spatial part of the metric unchanged. And then if I have time space terms in the metric, then I complete the square, like to bring them inside the parentheses like this. And then whatever's left over in front of the dt squared term, I call minus n squared. These variables have names. N is called the lapse, and ni is called the shift. So if you're thinking about 3 plus 1 dimensional GR, you can think about it as a field theory, if you want, in these variables. Let me explain in advance why these variables turn out to be so useful. So the main results that we're going to show are, so first off, there's this equation. I forgot to say that this equation has a name, which is the first Gauss-Kadazi equation. So that's one thing that we're going to show is that we're going to prove that. So this relates the 3 curvature to the 4 curvature. I like to put the explicit 3 and 4 on metrics, curvatures, and so on. Otherwise, I tend to get confused by my own notation. K is the object K is the extrinsic curvature, the thing I talked about before, a symmetric 3 by 3 matrix, and an explicit formula for it in these variables is this. And the other main result is the very famous ADM form of the action. So this is just a way of writing, an equivalent way of writing the Einstein-Hilbert action of general relativity in this 3 plus 1 dimensional variables. In this notation, the Einstein-Hilbert action would be written this way with an m Planck square root over 2. And this is equal to these variables. Oh, I forgot the minus. Oops, there's a square root of g3, then a factor of n, and then this mess. The reason this way, so this is sometimes called the ADM action. Were ADM or the initials of some famous relativists that I can't recall off the top of my head. The reason this is so powerful is that you can see when the action is written this way that the variables n and ni are non-dynamical. Whereas gij3 is dynamical and satisfies a second order equation of motion. One way of being sure that a variable is non-dynamical is if it appears in an action without time derivatives. Then when I vary, normally if you think about an action with time derivatives, say an action with first time derivatives, then the way you get a second order equation of motion is from some term that looks like this in the Euler-Lagrange equation. So a very, if phi is some field, the Euler-Lagrange equation looks like this. And if the action contains first time derivatives, then I'll generally get some first time derivatives here, and then this derivative will produce second derivatives, and I'll get a second order equation of motion. But if the field contains no time derivatives in the action, then if you think about the Euler-Lagrange equations, it can contain spatial derivatives. The Euler-Lagrange equations for that field will give you a differential equation that has spatial derivatives up to second order, but no time derivatives. And that's the definition of a non-dynamical field. It just means that its equation of motion, rather than looking schematically like phi double dot equals something, it just reads phi equals something. It just goes along for the ride and is determined in terms of other quantities. So if you chase through the definitions here, you can see that these variables just appear in the action with no time derivatives. There's an n here, but no n dot. There's an n here. There's an nk here, but with a spatial derivative. So this is the other half. This shows that out of the 10 degrees of freedom in GR, four of them are non-dynamical. I didn't fix a gauge yet, so the remaining 6 degrees of freedom that are dynamical still have the four-component gauge symmetry. And when I remove gauge modes, I'll get down to the 2 degrees of freedom, and we've explained how you get from 10 to 2. All right. So these are the main results that I want to show. The first Gauss-Kadazy equation and deriving the form of the ADM action. So we'll also get, I'm going to do the inflationary calculation in the ADM variables. So in addition to having this formula for the action, it's useful to just build up a list of formulas involving the ADM variable. So the first thing that I want to do is invert the metric. So starting from this form of the metric, what is the inverse metric? I have to admit that I had to stare at this for a minute before I saw the trick. Inverting this matrix, the inverse of this matrix, sort of non-obvious how to compute it, but it turns out to have a simple form. The way that I inverted it is I factored it as a product of matrices. This is kind of a trick, but I like this way of inverting the matrix. This factorization sort of looks like it comes out of nowhere, but if you think about it, it's just mimicking the steps of completing the square. And this formula says that if I contract with a four vector dt dxi to get the line element, that I start by shifting dxi by ni dt, That's what this matrix is doing. And then do a diagonal thing by contracting with a minus n squared and a gij. If that proof is too hand-wavy, you can just multiply out this chain of matrices and see that it is the partition matrix here. So if you have that trick, I think you need some sort of trick to do this inverse. This isn't the only possible trick, but it's... Oh, sorry, this was with lower mu. Yeah. If I have that trick, then... it's easy to invert the matrix. So the inverse of a matrix product is given by the product of inverses in the opposite order. So let me invert the middle matrix first. That's just n to the minus 2 and then the inverse 3 metric down here. When I say that I invert the 4 metric, what I really mean is that I found a way of writing it in terms of the inverse 3 metric. And then to invert this matrix, you just reverse the sign of the off-diagonal bit. Likewise over here. And then I multiplied out that chain of three matrices and got this answer. Notice that if I'm talking about the metric with lowered indices, then G4 is the same thing as G3, lowered spatial indices. But the same is not true for the inverse matrix, for the metric with upper indices. So in this case, it would be important to keep the 4 or 3 label. Likewise, the 0, 0, or analogously, the 0, 0 component of the inverse of the upper metric is something simple, n to the minus 2. But in the lower metric, there's this extra term. A way of writing this, which is convenient, so I can write this. A way of writing this, which will be convenient for the calculations, is to write it like this. Oh, I skipped a step. Never mind, I'll come back and explain what comes here. Well, another thing I want to say is that you can read off from this that the determinant of G, that comes up this. This quantity, or rather the square root of the determinant, is something that comes up in GR. Can just be read off from this factorization. Each of these matrices has determinant 1, and the matrix in the middle has determinant minus n squared times the determinant of G3. So from this factorization, you can read off that this is n times the square root of that G3. Next thing I want to write down is the unit normal vector. So a vector field X mu is tangent to the hypersurface. If its zeroth component is 0. Notice that that's not the same thing as saying that x lower 0 equals 0, because when I raise or lower indices on four vectors with the four metric, I have this off-diagonal term. There's a unit normal vector. Eta mu, which is defined by the requirement that it is, I want it to be orthogonal to all tangent vector fields. It should also satisfy eta mu equals minus 1. If you think about it, the first equation is saying that, this is a natural geometric definition. The first equation is saying that eta with a lower 0 index is 0. This contraction of the lower end, if eta is written with a lower index and x is written with an upper index, then the contraction doesn't involve the metric. If I want that contraction to be 0 whenever x mu is of the form 0 comma xi, that's equivalent to saying that, eta lower I is equal to 1, is equal to 0. That's equivalent to saying that all the spatial components of eta are 0 if eta is written with a lower index. So eta with a lower index has to be some 0 component followed by 3 zeros. And to get the value of the 0 component, to know what 0 component to write here, I use the second condition. If I contract eta with itself, then let's say I use the inverse 4 metric, which has this component. So I better put an n there if I want eta to self-contract to minus 1 when I put in the minus n to the minus 2 from the metric. You get the spirit of how these calculations are going to go. We're going to start just computing stuff and components in this setup and these variables. Notice that if I wrote eta, so eta lower I is equal to 0. Notice that eta written with an upper, if I write eta with an upper index, then the spatial components are not 0. They would be I'm lost in my notes, so I have to use my brain instead. Eta with an upper index, then its components are minus n to the minus 1 and n to the minus 1 ni. Okay. So I'm just going to continue. I'll stop here for today. I'm just going to continue doing calculations in these ADM variables. Next, we're going to work out, we worked out the metric. Next, we're going to work out Christoffel symbols, curvature, et cetera. And the goal is going to be to derive these two key formulas. See you tomorrow.